Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Friday, the 6th of December, these are our main stories. Nancy Pelosi announces the impeachment process against President Trump will go ahead. The World Health Organization says cases of measles are rising at a dangerous speed across the world. And the police are investigating a grenade found on a patio in Spain. Also in this podcast.
So we row 24 hours a day, but it's split into 90-minute shifts. So you row for 90 minutes, you sleep for 90 minutes, you row for 90 minutes, and you keep that going for about 3 weeks.
Six rowers are attempting what's been called the impossible journey from Cape Horn in South America to Antarctica. And we begin the podcast in Washington with news of a major development in the impeachment inquiry against US President Donald Trump. The Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, announced on Thursday that impeachment proceedings against the president would go ahead.
The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit. The president has engaged in abuse of power, undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Now, this doesn't mean that President Trump will be removed from office, but it does mean that formal charges against the president will now be drawn up. It's expected that a formal vote to impeach Mr. Trump will be held this month. Democrats hold a majority in the House, making the odds of it passing highly likely. After Nancy Pelosi's announcement, the Republican and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke at his weekly press conference.
This is the day the nation is weaker, because they surely cannot put their animosity or their fear of losing an election in the future in front of all the other things that the American people want. It's not a day that history will be proud of. It's not a day I hope America ever repeats.
Well, for more, I spoke to Chris Buckler, who's on Capitol Hill.
You heard both Mr. McCarthy and Mrs. Pelosi there referring to the fact that this is something historical, whether they like it or not. This is a moment because there have only been two presidents in the past who have been impeached, and it seems extremely likely now that Donald Trump is going to become the third. At times, Democrats pondered the whole idea of whether or not they should take this action. There is dangers for it in them as well as for the Republicans, but they have decided to go forward. And in that speech from Nancy Pelosi, you heard the Speaker of the House talk about the Declaration of Independence, talk about the Constitution, and say that this had to be done in her view, because if they allowed a president to be above the law, then they did so at the peril of their republic. That is what the Speaker of the House said. So you get this sense that this is a moment in Washington, but I'll tell you what, it's not going to heal any divides. It's only going to make them worse.
And what's been the reaction so far?
Well, you get a sense of that from what's been said. President Trump attacking Nancy Pelosi online, describing her as crazy. At one stage during a news conference she gave, she said she had prayed for the president. His response was, "I don't believe you." And the White House itself has said that the Democrats should be ashamed, although they did say that they look forward to a fair trial in the Senate. That is an acceptance that impeachment is going to happen, but also that it's going to have a trial inside the Senate, which is dominated by Republicans, that's members of Mr. Trump's party, and therefore it's highly unlikely he is going to be removed from office.
And what happens next? Because this is quite a long process, isn't it? It's going to be drawn out.
Yeah, I suspect you probably feel, Charlotte, it's already been a long process, given how much we've talked about impeachment. But from here, we have the Judiciary Committee meeting on Monday. That's the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee. They will start to draw up what are known as these articles of impeachment. They are the formal charges against the president. There will then be a House vote that takes place before Christmas. And then in January, we start that process of having a Senate trial right at the start of a bitter election year in America.
That was Chris Buckler. New figures from the World Health Organization suggest cases of measles are increasing at dangerously high levels across the world. Nearly 10 million people were infected with the viral disease last year, and more than 140,000 people, mostly children, were killed. That's an increase of almost 13% compared to last year. This year, the US reported its highest number of measles cases in nearly three decades, and the small Pacific nation of Samoa has been crippled by an ongoing measles outbreak. And that's even though a vaccine for the disease already exists. So why is this happening? Sheldon Yett, the UNICEF representative to the Pacific, is in Samoa and explained why this outbreak has been so widespread and severe.
I think it happened for a number of reasons. One is that there was probably not as much investment in routine immunization, in getting people to get the basic vaccinations, as we like to see. I think the other issue, too, is some of the anti-vaccination messages that have circulated on the internet. This is a country that has a very high penetration of social media. Of course, a lot of anti-vaxxers were on here in the country. And there are also folk remedies out there that people were taking, and that was preventing people from going to the hospital, and that was an issue as well.
Tule Seleli Mali Elegaioi is the Samoan Prime Minister. He believes that misinformation on social media is hampering his country's efforts to fight the disease.
We have asked many, many times over the radio, over the television, for people to come and get vaccinated free. But the problem is we have been handicapped by our drive because we have so many anti-vaccine people. And of course, many of our people still resort to traditional healers.
Our global affairs correspondent, Naomi Grimley, told me more about the picture internationally.
There's no doubt that the number of cases is going up. It's, of course, much better than it was back in 2000, but it's really about backsliding here. So, for example, in 2018, there were 9.7 million estimated measles cases, and that was up from the previous year, 7.5 million. As to why, it's a variety of reasons. In some developing countries, it's just a question of getting access to the vaccine. Maybe communities in remote areas aren't covered, or maybe instability and violence has disrupted the supply of vaccines. But it's also on the rise in some Western countries, and that might be to do with complacency, people thinking, oh, it's not a problem anymore, so I don't need to get my child vaccinated. And of course, also anti-vax campaigns, which is a big part of the reason why people think it may have been rising here in Britain.
Yes, because if you type this into the internet, you can come up with so much fake news about vaccines and really high profile figures saying lies about vaccines and spreading it further.
That's right. And it has become more of a problem because of the growth of social media. It's very difficult for parents to navigate the advice they're given. And the onus really is now on health organisations, health ministries and those big multinational bodies to try and come up with the information that everyone needs, that they get good scientific facts when they're making these decisions. It's clearly something which is really preoccupying Professor Kate O'Brien, who's the World Health Organization's Director of Immunization.
This is a very high concern for us because families, parents are really vulnerable to misinformation. It's very difficult to discern if you're not somebody who understands where the information is coming from, to discern accurate, scientific, credible information from misinformation.
how dangerous is measles? Is that part of the problem that people don't perhaps realise it can be fatal?
Indeed. I mean, it is very contagious. So if you get to the point where there's a pocket of the population that is unvaccinated, it can take hold very quickly. That's why the WHO says you need at least 95% of the population immunised. Often the deaths are to do with secondary complications. So it's things like encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain, also pneumonia. And that is why we've seen with the recent outbreak in Samoa, the majority of deaths, I think there have been about 62 so far, but the majority are children under the age of five because they are the least likely to be able to fend off those kind of infections.
That was Naomi Grimley. An Italian newspaper has defended its front page after it was heavily criticised and accused of fueling racism. Its headline, Black Friday, featured two black footballers, Romelu Lukaku and Chris Smalling, ahead of their meeting in a match on Friday. Mike Sanders from our Europe desk told me more.
Black Friday, well, firstly, it's a week late, isn't it, really? So it's not a brilliant headline. It was supposed to showcase a duel between these two players who both used to play for Manchester United and now Romelu Lukaku, the Belgian striker who plays for Inter Milan. He will be facing Chris Smalling, who plays for Roma. Smalling is a defender, when they play each other tomorrow. And it was a kind of way of setting up an internal duel between this bigger match. But it hasn't gone down very well, and a lot of campaign groups have said it actually incites racism.
And have we heard from the players?
Yeah, we've heard from both of them. Lukaku, he says that Corriere dello Sport, which is the newspaper, has come up with what he calls one of the dumbest headlines I've ever seen in my career. And he says, you guys keep fueling the negativity and the racism issue. Education is the key. You guys at Corriere dello Sport should do a better job at that. And Smalling says, it's important that I acknowledge that what occurred this morning was wrong and highly insensitive. I hope the editors involved in running this headline take responsibility and understand the power they possess through the words they use.
And this isn't the first time football supporters have faced this kind of criticism. I'm thinking of Lazio and their ultra fans, black players saying, you know, they're abused.
Lots of black players have said that. Lukaku himself has been abused in Cagliari, the Sicilian team, in September, and nothing was done about it. Nothing was done. I think that's the key point, that it keeps on happening and there's very little sanction. Mario Balotelli, another prime example, he threatened to walk off during a game for Brescia last month, and it was then caught up in a very dodgy play on words by his own chairman, who said, you know, Balotelli is black but he'll lighten up. Well, yeah. Black being a kind of play on the words also means black, black mood, black angry, you know, but again didn't go down well. And Piara Povar of the anti-racism group FAR told the BBC in September that we believe the Italian authorities and the disciplinary system is simply not fit for purpose, and there's no meaningful response to the endemic racism in the stadiums.
That was Mike Sanders. Let's stay in Italy, where a new political movement is rapidly gaining support. Called the Sardines, in reference to the thousands packing squares across the country, often holding images of the fish, it's a protest against the far-right politician Matteo Salvini, who's aiming to win a key regional election next month. Initially started by four flatmates from Bologna to organise a flash mob to outnumber Salvini's League Party launch campaign a couple of weeks ago, the success of the Sardines has taken many Italians by surprise. From Milan, Mark Lowen reports.
Milano, Milano, Milano non si lega.
Well, as the evening December rain falls here in Milan's Piazza Duomo, in the shadow of the city's 14th century cathedral, a sea of umbrellas and a sea of what they call sardines. Thousands of people packed like the fish into this square, as they have in cities right across Italy, for a movement that began just last month.
Siamo tutti antifascisti!
People rising up in support of the values they believe in: democracy, equality, and against hatred and racism. And the politician they feel embodies that, the far-right leader Matteo Salvini.
Populism tried to spread hate and fear for between people and to it tried to divide people. The great example is people coming from another country. Maybe they are escaping from war, and they are trying to make us have fear of them and aid them, and we don't want this.
Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao.
Their anthem, the anti-fascist song Bella Ciao, is a rebuke to the policies of Salvini, the former deputy prime minister and leader of the far-right League Party. Milan is his hometown, but the Sardines have come here before regional elections in nearby Emilia-Romagna, a stronghold of the left for decades, that the League could take.
Are you afraid that he could win control of Emilia-Romagna region in January?
He's got potential, and lots of people are supporting him, supporting his like agenda of hate and fear for foreigners.
And if that happens, and he wins control of a really leftist region of Italy, what would that mean for you?
Well, it means that we just have to do better of him and for the future, and keep going and keep doing what I'm doing.
The extraordinary thing about this movement is just how quickly it has grown. From the idea of four flatmates just 2 or 3 weeks ago as a flash mob, growing to this, filling squares in cities across Italy from north to south. It feels like it has taken people by surprise, taken Italy by surprise, taken Matteo Salvini by surprise. A popular uprising against populism.
Mattia Santori, one of the Sardines' founders, was in Milan.
It's an energy we didn't expect, so we are trying to put this energy into the squares, and this is the emergency now, this is the urgency now, and then we're going to see maybe after the regional election in Emilia-Romagna how to keep this energy on.
Matteo Salvini, usually controlling the narrative through social media, has struggled to find a response to a sudden, peaceful movement that he can't dismiss as violent leftists. Interviewed recently, he tried to be sardonic about the Sardines.
I really like fish, raw, cooked, marinated.
But then he went for a softer approach to take the sting out of the Sardines' tail.
I love whoever informs themselves and decides to participate, so I'd hug them one by one and welcome them. I know they follow me everywhere with affection and curiosity. I'm looking forward to seeing them all over Italy. The more people participate, the better.
Italy has seen street movements that have risen and died. One now struggling is the Five Star, which started in 2007, became the biggest party, but is now declining. Professor Francesco Giavazzi is from Milan's Bocconi University.
These movements have a very unpredictable path. What they need is a focus to react to. So in the Five Star was political corruption. Now the focus is Salvini. If Salvini loses in Emilia-Romagna, which is now increasingly likely, the Sardine will have a lot of responsibility for that. And this will push them a lot. Now, where to, we don't know. But this will be the proof that they matter.
The reality is that Matteo Salvini is still Italy's most popular politician, and polls say he would easily win elections. But something is bubbling here, and the Sardines might just turn Italy's political tide.
That was Mark Lowen reporting from Milan. Coming up in the second half of the podcast.
We are going to Bosnia, we'll go to camp. I say, camp? I'm not here for camp. I'm valid. I have a valid visa.
How did two Nigerian table tennis players end up in an immigration camp in Bosnia? To Burkina Faso now, a landlocked country in West Africa, where nearly 500,000 people have been internally displaced due to armed violence. The number of attacks by groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group keeps rising. This year, there have been four times more civilian deaths than 12 months ago. In response, the security forces have scaled up counter-terrorism operations. But reports are emerging that some of these operations have fueled allegations of extrajudicial killings. Our West Africa correspondent, Louise de Wast, sent this report from Burkina Faso.
I think I was very lucky in my childhood because I remember up to when I was 6 years old, I can still remember my dad holding me in his arms.
That's a man we will call Jibril. He comes from a Fulani community in northern Burkina Faso, where Islamist militants are known to operate. Security forces are present in the area fighting them. But Jibril says that in October, about 20 soldiers came for his father, who they suspected was aiding militants.
I was called around 8:30 on Saturday, October 26, by my brother. He told me this. The military came and took our dad and went with him.
An hour later, his brother found 9 bodies lying in a shallow grave about 10 kilometers away. Their father was among them.
So they were killed in 2 groups next to a bush, and their shoes were still there when I went and visited the place.
Jibril is still reeling from his loss.
We were very close. The Fulani culture, most of the time there's this distance between children and their parents. Like, you wouldn't commonly see a dad taking their children in their arms, for instance. Even when the child would be crying, they would call the woman to come and check on the baby. But my dad was kind of different.
One of the main militant groups, Ansarul al-Islam, was founded by a Fulani man, Ibrahim Diko, which is why some people wrongly believe that all Fulani support the group. But they are the second largest ethnic community in Burkina Faso, making up 9.5% of the population, according to the latest census.
Clearly, today, when you are a man and a Fulani and living in a village, you fall into the stereotype of a terrorist. This is what the authorities, like the military, I wouldn't say all of them, but there's definitely a group in the military that is operating using those lenses. This is clear.
It was not safe for the BBC to travel to the area to verify Jibril's story, nor was it possible to confirm the identity of the perpetrators.
Do you think it's possible that your father was involved with the wrong people?
Anyone can be today suspected, but anyone should also have that right. Once you are taken, not armed, a civilian, you have to go through a process, and this is what I was expecting. But from my knowledge, my dad was just struggling to live.
We asked the government spokesman, Rémi Danjinu, if allegations of unlawful killings were true.
Let me tell you that certain people in the military have been discharged and their cases are being taken care of within the army. But it's not because one person made a mistake that it means that there is a systematic effort to target a community.
Jibril isn't the first to speak out on unlawful killings. Human Rights Watch has documented 14 similar allegations between 2017 and early 2018, as well as 19 other incidents between September 2018 and February this year. The vast majority of those involved were Fulani. Attacks by militant groups remain the number one cause of civilian deaths in Burkina Faso, but Jibril warns that the more people feel unsafe, the more at risk they are of joining the wrong side.
That was Louise de Wast. Next, in Spain, people have been reading and sharing the story of an attack that happened at a centre for migrant children in Madrid. A grenade was found on a patio, which police believe was thrown over the wall on Wednesday. The centre was evacuated while experts carried out a controlled explosion. For more, Divya Arya spoke to Maria Ramirez, a journalist at El Yurio, a Spanish online newspaper based in Madrid.
There's still a police investigation on who's behind the attack, which is still unclear. There's a big political debate around this because this is a center for teenagers who are protected by the government because they have suffered abuse at home or because they have arrived to Spain without their parents. And many of them are migrants, but not all of them. And this particular place have been a chosen place by some far-right politicians to actually do campaign in the front of this building. So now there is a huge debate about whether these far-right politicians campaigning around the center maybe have some connection with the attacks, with some people who might be inspired by this rhetoric.
And this is not the first attack on this place.
Yeah, actually there have been incidents, minor incidents until now, but there have been several incidents, like at the end of October, a group of young people, also minors, tried to enter the building to apparently try to attack some young migrants. And there's been graffitis and threats, mostly from young people as well, mobilized through social media, WhatsApp group and all these social media around this center. So there's been nothing really serious, but there's been a lot of threats and minor attacks.
And have people from the center responded to this attack?
Well, many are quite young. They are between 14 and 17, and some they are scared. I mean, you can actually enter and talk to the minors usually in the center because of protection of minors. So we journalists can't actually enter the center. But some of the minors around outside the center have expressed just fear. And these are teenagers who have gone through a lot already because they came to Spain by themselves, so because they are maybe escaping abuse from home. So they have already suffered a lot. So this actually is scary that somehow they are becoming a target.
But what about the people in charge of the center? Have they responded, or indeed the government?
Yes, the government, the Minister of Interior, has condemned the attacks, and actually he has expressly linked these attacks to the rhetoric by the far-right party, Vox, this new far-right party that we have in Spain, and the kind of rhetoric that they are using against migrants in general, but also against young migrants in this center in particular. So the Minister of Interior have been quite clear about that. And in the case of the people who work at the center, well, they are actually complaining that the center is not in good conditions, that they need more security, and they should have more personnel to take care of the minors there.
That was Maria Ramirez, a journalist at El Yurio in Spain. Two Nigerian table tennis players who travelled to Croatia last month to attend a competition have ended up wrongly detained at a freezing camp for undocumented migrants in Bosnia, Farhana Darwood reports.
Abia Alexandro and Ibo Chinedu are students at the Federal University of Technology Owerri in Nigeria. In November, they travelled to Pula in Croatia with visas to attend the university games. After they returned to the capital, Zagreb, they say they were picked up on a night out by police who thought they were in the country illegally.
He don't understand English. We tried to introduce ourselves to him. He refused to listen to us.
Despite their legal right to be there, the men were then transported to neighbouring Bosnia and ended up in a camp in Velika Kladuša, where thousands of migrants are stuck in tents without water or heating, and temperatures as low as minus 2 degrees.
So the other one also said, if you do move, I will shoot you. I was scared. I started crying. We are going to Bosnia, we go to camp. I said, camp? I'm not here for camp. I'm valid. I have a valid visa.
It's thought the men are still at the camp. Their supporters are demanding they're flown back to Nigeria. Bosnia's Minister of Security, Dragan Metic, said the men had valid Croatian visas and that they are now illegally in Bosnia. The Croatian police have denied behaving incorrectly. They say they suspected an attempted misuse of participation in sports competitions to get into the European Union. Rights groups, however, have repeatedly accused the Croatian police of using heavy-handed tactics with migrants and refugees, including a strategy of unlawful and often violent deportations.
That was Farhana Darwood. And finally, it's been called the Impossible Row, the 1,200-kilometre trip from Cape Horn in South America to Antarctica is considered the most dangerous in the world. But a six-member crew is planning to make the trip from next Thursday, tackling waves of up to 25 metres and freezing temperatures. They will have a support boat following them, but they say it will provide no assistance. One of the rowers, Jamie Douglas-Hamilton, has been speaking about the project to my colleague Matthew Amroli-Waller.
It's really to show that what looks crazy from the outset, once you break it all down, these things can actually be done. And we were told before we rode the Indian Ocean from Australia to Africa that that was impossible. We're foolhardy and that we're crazy and it couldn't be done. But we got across. And once we'd done that, we realised there's a lot more you can actually do. You can push yourself so much harder than what you realise.
Just explain to us, because you've done all the research, just explain to our viewers just how harsh the conditions are in this stretch of water, how frightening it is, basically.
It was actually quite scary. Last night I had a look at the weather forecast over the next 2 weeks, and right now it's blowing a force 8 around Cape Horn, and there's a force 10, that's only two on the Beaufort scale, away from a hurricane that's moving into the Drake Passage. It will be very cold. The water will get down to freezing. Seawater freezes at about minus two, so it will be between freezing to about 2 degrees. So if you go in the water, you've got 2 to 5 minutes of survival time. That's why you need to get out very, very quickly. And the big issue with that is that we're going to capsize. All the weather is coming from the west to the east, and we're going southwards.
What about basic things like food, water, sleep? How do you sleep? How long do you row for?
So we row 24 hours a day, but it's split into 90-minute shifts. So you row for 90 minutes, you sleep for 90 minutes, you row for 90 minutes, and you keep that going for about 3 weeks. It's pretty hard to sleep in that time frame. So you probably get about 3 hours sleep or thereabouts per day. So it's a tough. It's pretty tough.
Rather him than me, I think. That was Jamie Douglas-Hamilton, who's attempting that epic row. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
Today, more people live in cities than outside of them. And by 2050, a whopping 70% of the world's population will be living in urban areas. Cities shape our lives, and they're only becoming more important. I'm Greg Lindsay, host of Brighter Talks, a new podcast series from Covestro that looks at ideas and innovations for our future cities. In each episode, we hear from architects, technology innovators, mobility directors, and more. Listen now and join us as we explore ideas for a brighter future.